Welcome in to Outkick the Show. I am your fearless leader, Clay Travis. I hope all of you are having fantastic Thursdays wherever you may be across this great country or around the world. We got three really big stories here today. Sometimes there's like 7-8 stories. Sometimes there's not really a big story. I would argue we got three big stories today of all different sorts of significance. O.J. Simpson has died. I'm going to tell you my thoughts on O.J. Simpson and his legacy. Shohei Ohtani, there is a complaint out accusing his translator of bank fraud. The numbers are frankly staggering. I will discuss that. And also, Scott Drew has said no to the University of Kentucky for their basketball job and is going to stay in Waco, Texas. Those three big stories I'm going to dive into here. I've been doing media all day since the O.J. Simpson death occurred. So let's go ahead and begin there. O.J. Simpson dead at the age of 76. What are our thoughts on this? I'm not even going to talk about the sports career because O.J.'s sports career predated my sports fandom, and I never remember watching O.J. Simpson as an athlete. I knew him entirely as an actor, as a sideline reporter, as a corporate pitchman, and as an alleged murderer. So let me start here. There are 4 days in my childhood that I can remember exactly where I was when these events happened. And I'm defining childhood up to about the age of 21 or 22, my youth. The first was the Challenger explosion. It was the snow day. I was at the local community center playing pool and ping pong. 7 years old, I believe. Challenger explodes. I remember exactly where I was as that story played out. Second one, O.J. Simpson, multiple O.J. Simpson stories. I remember where I was when the Bronco chase happened. I remember where I was when the O.J. verdict came out. I remember I was in high school at the time when they wheeled in televisions to allow the O.J. verdict. I was watching, as were many of you, television when the O.J. Simpson Bronco chase happened. I saw Joe Concha tweeted this out. 95 million people were watching the white Bronco. 100 million people were watching the verdict when it came down. It was on all channels. I remember where I was when I found out Princess Di died. And I remember where I was when 9/11 happened. I was a freshman at George Washington University when Princess Di died. I remember everybody gathering around. There was only one television in our dorm. Most people didn't have dorm televisions at that point in time. Obviously, I don't think hardly anybody had a cell phone. Everybody was tuned into television. And on 9/11, I've said this before, but I was a first-year law student at Vanderbilt. I was in my torts class. The current dean of Vanderbilt Law School, Chris Guthrie, was our professor. We went in knowing that planes had flown into the towers. When we came out, they had wheeled out televisions into the main area of Vanderbilt Law School, and I stood there watching the Twin Towers fall. Those all were major events that occurred, from the time I was 6 or 7 years old till about 22 years old. And the O.J. Simpson trial and the way that it captured America, if you are younger and you're watching or listening to this right now, you probably don't really understand. It captivated the country and was the number one news story in the country for about a year. I'm now a lawyer, grown up. I was 14 or 15 years old when O.J. happened. O.J. was guilty. The evidence is quite clear based on all the reading that I've done. I'd encourage you to read Jeffrey Toobin's book, The People versus O.J. Simpson. The evidence is quite clear that O.J. murdered in cold blood two different people, Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Goldman. And he should have, in an honest justice system, been found guilty of those murders. He was not, because of racial identity politics. As some form of perverse retribution for the Rodney King case, OJ argued that he was being set up because of racism, that there was someone else who was the killer, and that he should be found not guilty. Now, I understand some people who say, oh, it wasn't beyond a reasonable doubt. If I had been on that jury, it was beyond a reasonable doubt, in my opinion. I don't begrudge F. Lee Bailey or Johnny Cochran or Barry Scheck or any of the OJ attorneys who did their best job to defend their client who was accused of a heinous double murder. I have represented, back when I was a lawyer, people accused of crimes, murder, domestic violence, drug dealing. When I was in the U.S. Virgin Islands, everybody got assigned criminal cases because they didn't have enough lawyers, and I worked on those cases. So I don't begrudge any lawyer who represents someone accused of dastardly acts. John Adams represented the shooters at the Boston Tea Party. I believe it is the job of a lawyer to provide zealous advocacy for individuals, even if you believe they are guilty, or even if you are of the opinion that they are that they may well have done it. Right? That's the job of a zealous advocate. So I don't begrudge any of that. I don't hold it against anyone. I don't have any issue with the defense attorneys. I think Marsha Clark and Christopher Darden, I think, as the prosecutors here, did a less than stellar job. But I think ultimately the jury, which found O.J. Simpson not guilty, bears the blame here. And sometimes juries get things wrong. Right? That just happens. You can believe in the jury system and also acknowledge that sometimes juries get it wrong. That's why there's appeals. I think the jury got it wrong. Later, OJ was found civilly liable for murder, for wrongful death. They bankrupted him. He later went to prison because he was convicted of robbery and kidnapping in Las Vegas related to his attempt to get back some of his memorabilia. And so that felt like some measure of late justice to some people. I never thought it was enough. And I understand there's this idea, you don't speak ill of the dead. To my knowledge, OJ has never accepted responsibility for the murder. He's never apologized. He's never sought forgiveness. He's never sought redemption. And so I hope he rots in hell. I don't have any compunction about saying that at all. I think if you commit an evil act, and in this case, I believe OJ committed two evil acts, and you don't pay for it, and you never seek redemption or you never seek forgiveness, then I have no qualms about saying, I think you should rot in hell for the evil that you took and put forth upon the earth. And so I think OJ was a forerunner of the modern era that we have created of this woke industrial complex where no one is individually responsible for their acts. Everyone is merely an actor in the oppression pyramid. And if you are a significant enough of a victim, that is, you're trans, you're a black woman, you're a black man, your guilt or innocence is assessed on the pyramid of victimization. And instead of being responsible for your own behavior, larger society is put on trial. And I saw this tweet, which I thought was reflective of that. And I want to read it for you. This is from Mark Lamont Hill. I don't know him. O.J. Simpson was an abusive liar who abandoned his community long before he killed two people in cold blood. His acquittal for murder was the correct and necessary result of a racist criminal legal system, but he's still a monster, not a martyr. Again, the key line here is, and this is what people who believe in critical race theory, This is what people who believe in the oppression pyramid, this is what people who believe in identity politics believe. Justice, and justice is in quotation marks here, is often required for there to be injustice because society's unfair. His acquittal, this is what Mark Lamont Hill said, his acquittal for murder was the correct and necessary result of a racist criminal legal system. You might have heard me and Buck talking about this on the show just a little while ago. My concern is that if OJ happened in the modern era, there would actually be far more people arguing, so he may have done it, so what? The system is so unjust that there can be no punishment levied against him. In other words, America's so racist that there is no ability to have justice in this case, and so OJ should be found not guilty. I think that would be even more of a paramount feature of argument today than it was in 1994 and 1995. And so to me, OJ is a murderer, a double murderer. I hope that the Nicole Brown Simpson family and Ronald Goldman's family feels some measure of justice in living long enough to see OJ die, but he should have spent the rest of his days in a prison for double murder. His ability to avoid punishment was actually a use of OJ, of actual racism that did exist in this country. I'm not somebody who runs around and is blind to the history of the country, but you don't solve past racism with present racism. So OJ traded on past racist history and past victims of racism to save himself in 1995. And in 1994, from any culpability for his own actions. I think he is an awful human, and I hope that if there is a hell, that OJ rots there, because that's where he belongs for committing double murder of two innocent people. And that those are my thoughts on OJ. And if you're young and you are listening to me talk about OJ, or you're hearing your parents or your grandparents talk about it, you didn't live through it, or you don't remember it in 1994, 1995, I would really encourage you to go read Jeffrey Toobin's book, which they turned into a television series. Again, I would always encourage you to read rather than watch. But The People versus O.J. Simpson, I think, is a must-read if you are in any way interested in the law, interested in sports, interested in that era that many of us lived through and how it could impact us today. I would encourage all of you to go and check that out. Okay, Shohei Ohtani. We got double super serious legal-related stories here that are hitting. Shohei Ohtani gambling case. I'm reading from the I said, you go back and watch me talk about the revelation of the Shohei Ohtani case. I said it didn't add up. And I'm going to be honest with y'all as I hit you with some of the details that are in this bank fraud allegation case. According to this affidavit, this what was filed, Shohei Ohtani's translator lost $40.7 million of Shohei Ohtani's money. The prior report was that there was $4 million lost and that Shohei Ohtani's attempt to cover those losses was what turned this into a story. The new report is that there were 19,000 bets placed, an average of 25 bets a day over the past few years. The average bet size was $12,800. It went all the way up to $160,000, and that this was $40.7 million in total losses. People think I'm a bad gambler, by the way. Shohei Ohtani's translator won $142 million in gambling wins. He lost $182 million in gambling wins. And this is pretty absolutely pretty different, crazy situation here. So again, $40.7 million in losses that I think all of you are kind of like hearing and being like, oh my God, is this real? It seems crazy to me that he could have lost $40.7 million and that no one out there would have any idea on Shohei Ohtani's team that somehow $40 million of his cash had been lost. That's the biggest story to me. If Shohei Ohtani, and it appears to be the story, they are claiming that he is totally innocent and that he had no knowledge of this, how in the world did almost $41 million of his money vanish and nobody even noticed? I mean, he's got to fire everybody who advises him. And I mean, honestly, like this just kind of boggles the mind that this could ever occur. And that this translator could be able to make this many moves. Now, they say he didn't know. They say the bets were not made on baseball, which is convenient for Major League Baseball. But to me, this raises even more questions. Because I thought it was crazy that $4 million could have ended up vanishing. And Shohei not have known. Now they're saying over the course of a couple of years that $40 million vanished, and almost $41 million, and Shohei Ohtani had no idea. And I get some guys are like totally not involved in their finances. $41 million. How many people ever even have $40 million in cash? I mean, honestly, where someone could even steal $41 million from you. This story, I got to be honest with you, it even sounds crazier now than it did before, and I thought it sounded crazier before. So that is all of the stories that are out there relating to Shohei Ohtani. I'm going to continue to follow this. These are both obviously super serious stories, both O.J. Simpson dying and everything associated with his life post-football, and also now Shohei Ohtani in the gambling case that involved his translator, who I would think would have to go to prison for years and years now. I just find it staggering. If Shohei Ohtani is truly a victim here, it wasn't just that Shohei is a victim. It's that he was failed by his banks. Surely he has financial advisors, the team. Nobody noticed $41 million get stolen from him. It's staggering for me to even think about. Scott Drew, much less serious story here. Scott Drew has turned down the job at the University of Kentucky. So for anybody out there who's watching with me right now, Adam, let me know if anything else is out there about this, if Kentucky, there's any other details about their pursuit and who their guy is going to be at this point now. But Scott Drew came out and said that God wanted him to stay in Waco, Texas, and continue to coach at Baylor. And he put up this message, hashtag joy. In our program, we strive to put Jesus first, then others, then ourselves. We truly believe God has called my family and I to continue our work here at Baylor, surrounded by the best people and community anyone could be blessed to have. We are grateful for the support of Mac Rhodes, President Livingstone, and the entire Baylor family, and we look forward to working together to bring more championships to Waco. This is kind of what I hinted at the other day. We had Scott Drew on the program a few times with Outkick back in the day when I was doing early morning radio show. I'm not claiming to know him well, but he never seemed to me to be a guy motivated by the pursuit of money above all else. And I think this is a really good lesson. His hashtag of joy. If you love your job, and you love the community that your family lives in, why chase something more if you're already incredibly satisfied with what you have? I think it's a really important message. When I started OutKick, I was told, you're going to have to move to New York or LA to really run a media company. You can't do it from Nashville. When are you going to move to New York? When are you going to move to LA? And I've had the opportunity to move both places at different points in time, and I certainly have traveled some over the years, quite a lot, as a part of that. But I have always felt that my family is happy here, and I'm not going to move. And I've turned down opportunities that would have required me to leave Nashville because I'm happy here with the life that I have and the life that our family has. And I kind of felt like Scott Drew was the same way. A lot of people would say, oh my goodness, you can't turn down the University of Kentucky basketball job. It's just too good. You know, when I took over alongside a Buck for the Clay Travis Buck Sexton show, I'm fortunate to have the same boss. They came after me. I didn't pursue it. But I said, okay, I'm not leaving Nashville. Rush was based in Florida. Our staff still lives in New York City, which is the primary studio there. I said, I'm not going to leave. When I got the Fox Sports Radio national morning show, I said, I'm not willing to move. We had conversations over the years about moving to LA for Fox Sports, about moving to New York for a variety of different jobs. I've just never been willing to do it. I said the other day on the show, talking about Scott Giroux, I didn't take the biggest offer for OutKick. I wanted the best fit, best opportunity to grow. I felt like Scott Drew was going to make the same decision. So we'll see where Kentucky goes from here. But I do think whatever you do for a living, there's a time and a place to move and a time and a place to change jobs. And certainly I've done that a lot. And some of the times I haven't ended up in a better place. But if you are really happy with what you do, and if you genuinely enjoy it, I think it's very hard to get people to leave. And I give credit to Scott Drew. He's won a national championship at Baylor. He can do it again. His family is happy in Waco. Why take on the Kentucky job? More power to him. We'll see where Kentucky goes. If I were Kentucky, I'd go hire Bruce Pearl. I don't even know if he's on their list. Or Rick Pitino. I don't imagine Hurley is going to say yes. They'll probably put a ton of money on his plate. But he's already won two championships at UConn. Why does he need to move? If his family's happy there, I would stay. I just think this is really an interesting time. And I think a lot of people, especially in this NIL era, are recognizing that having the support structure around you matters a lot more than the job does. And I think you can win championships anywhere if you got the right coach and you've got the right structure to support you. All right. Love all of you. My name is Clay Travis. May or may not do a show tomorrow. I got a cold. You can see I'm also traveling a ton. I got to be all over the place soon. So we'll see what happens with the stories going forward. DBAP, unless you need SBAP, I am Clay Travis. This has been OutKick, the show.